Hi, and welcome to Revision Media with me, Paul Stevenson, on this Thursday, the 23rd of July, 2020. Where did I get the 7th from? Oh, yes, July is the 7th, isn't it? Welcome, everyone. I hope you've had a great day. And through here from 10 p.m. till 11 p.m. in London in the UK. That's 5 till 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I think it's 1 till 2 Pacific Time, wherever you are around the world. I hope you've had a great day. Thank you for tuning in. And I must say, it's been very muggy over here generally, and there's a nice welcome breeze blowing through where I'm living here at the moment. And as I say, it's much appreciated because it's been very muggy. For the most part, in London and in the southeast, over the last month really, with a few days here and there, with a bit of a break from it. But yeah, I hope I find you all well. The unprecedented and challenging year that 2020 has been so far continues. I guess the main stories over here has been some good news insofar as gold and silver are moving nicely. Silver has finally moved and suddenly moved and dramatically moved. So it was worth the wait when it came. It's basically gone from $15 up as high as I think it's $23.50 at one point. I think now at the minute it's down around about $22.50. So in our money, that's gone from about, I think, about £13 up till £18. It's a dramatic move in a metal which has been stagnant for so long, really, and has been in a bear market for a long time. So for those of us who are holding silver, or those of us who have silver stocks, that's encouraging, and obviously for gold too. But generally, we've had, you know, tomorrow, for example, it has become mandatory now from tomorrow for citizens here in England to wear face masks in shops, Tesco, Sainsbury's, all the big superstores. If you want to go and get your groceries, you have to wear masks. This has apparently been designed to inspire confidence in people to go out shopping and to try and get the economy running again. But I actually think it's going to have the opposite effect, because there's just going to be more people, I believe, who are going to resent being dictated to by the state under the name of safety and security. It's usually how governments attempt to infringe on civil liberties and exercise further control, if allowed. A lot of the time it's pathological audacity on their part, and they chance it to see how far they can go. And they've gone pretty far already with this. They've locked down the country over the last two months. They've obliterated the economy. Anyone thinking it's going to be a V-shaped recovery and that we're just going to pop back out of this and everything's going to be normal, anybody with any sense, including myself, we're doing videos about it and podcasts about it at the time saying, there isn't going to be any V-shaped recovery. The implications of this are going to be disastrous, and they are going to be felt for a long time. And they haven't been felt yet. The dominoes haven't quite fallen yet, because the government's been printing up money, doing stimulus in all the Western countries, but particularly in the US, where most of my listeners are, and over here as well. Massive deficits, creating money out of thin air. Where's the money coming from? They're broke. It's not like they have a trillion in reserves or something, so for a rainy day. The government is already in debt to its teeth. It's just printing more money up. Add to that, you have got a citizenry who's going to be experiencing unprecedented levels of unemployment. So where are they going to collect the money from to pay it back? So to think that somehow it's just all going to be normal again. This is probably never going to be normal again. And in many ways, it's social engineering and conditioning people. And they, how they operate this way is by these incremental stages where they try it out and let's see, we'll have a lockdown and, you know, and we'll let make people wear masks if they go for that. And before you know it, these things just become normal to people. It's just conditioning. And the new normal is established. And in many ways, it's already established. And of course, you can get a £100 fine if you don't adhere to these mask rules. And of course, you're going to have, you know, a lot of people who are, you know, looking at you with, you know, sinister intentions, perhaps, thinking that you're irresponsible and, you know, don't care about spreading the disease. And of course, you've now got a distinction between people, and they tend to do fall on the same kind of political divides of sort of left and right, you know, compliant to government and to the state, and believing everything that comes out of the establishment, including the media, the government, the technocracy, the so-called scientific experts, and those who are a little bit more, not even rebellious, but in most cases informed, are distrusting of government, knowing government's history and knowing their appetites for power, who value civil liberties and freedom, don't like being dictated to, are much more likely to think for themselves. And you now have a visible distinction. And I remember back in March thinking, I'm going to do a video. And I wish I'd done it. Not that it matters now, but at the time when this first happened and, you know, masks were mentioned, I forget who it was, but I remember looking at it was some government guy, and it was just his body language. To me, said at the time he was lying. When he said, no, masks, we're not, you know, we're not looking at masks as a mandatory thing. And he kind of dismissed it. And it never really came up again for a long time. But I remember at the time thinking that they had already decided at that point that they wanted to bring masks in. And there may be some people in government who genuinely think that it's a good idea for the safety of people. But more often than not, safety and security is a facade and a mask to infringe and impose on your civil liberties. As Benjamin Franklin said, any man who gives up his freedom for temporary security deserves neither freedom or security. It was the same thing happened with 9/11. They brought in laws then that are still in existence today. You know, there's an old saying, there is nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. Try getting your ball back once you've given it over to them. Try getting those civil liberties back once you've relinquished them. And the economy and the whole system now is a mess. Whether this is by design or incompetence, I think in many cases it's a case of both. But the government all the while have marched people up the hill and scared them to death with the, you know, bringing lockdowns in, and now saying we've got to have masks. And why should we have masks at this time when it's the COVID cases and or COVID deaths are at an all-time low? I know their answer is, you know, to protect against the second wave. But why not do it when all these deaths were happening? Why would you not throw everything at it then? And say, well, it's worth a try. Let's give it a go. But people aren't really dying in masks. I think the last count was something like 11 in one day. And the whole thing about dying with COVID-19 and dying of COVID-19, you never hear this discussed in the media. You know, a lot of deaths, a lot of these deaths have been amplified. There, you know, there's been evidence to that effect where, you know, people are dying with coronavirus, not of coronavirus. We know this is the case, and it's quite common sometimes with prostate cancer. There's quite a lot of people die with prostate cancer, but they, you know, they died of something else. So anyway, we're now having to wear masks. And as I say, you're going to have this visible distinction now. And of course, the government can measure compliance and how much control they have over people by looking at and seeing who's wearing masks and who's not. And if enough people wear these masks, it's only going to embolden the control freaks that are our governments. Meanwhile, they're encouraging people to go back to work, all the while they've created all this fear. So this is a mess too. I mean, central London is largely dead, certainly in the context of what it normally is, except for the construction workers who obviously can't work from home. But of course, there's an irony here to my mind. I mean, who or what are these buildings for now? They're certainly not for office space, if that's the intention. There's huge amounts of empty commercial real estate, as you call it over there in the States. We call it just, property, commercial property. It's noticeable when you're driving around, even in the sort of suburb areas. A lot of, you see just a lot of overgrown kind of gardens and weeds and things which are not being maintained. And of course, if you're a company where a large percentage of your, and in central London, this would be the case, a large percentage of your outlay is in your office property expenditure. And then you go into lockdown, and simultaneously you discover that you can operate your business without that office space reasonably effectively from people working at home, and that your business has taken a significant hit. Even in the 2 months, it was enough. I mean, most people, a month, you had passed the point of no return of anything being the same again. The Western nations and the global nations are just leveraged up with debt to the point that something like that is devastating, even for a month. So those two factors combined are hardly going to encourage companies to want to go back into their offices, start renting their offices again, and spending probably, I don't know, 20, 25%, 30%, 40%, who knows, of their outlay on commercial properties. So, who these buildings are for, I do not know. Because the other phenomenon is because you are having people working from home, a lot of people are going to leave. Why stay in London in your really expensive flat? I mean, some people will, if they're earning good enough money and they can keep their jobs. That's another question. When the furlough stops, how many of these companies are going to be there, let alone the jobs? But anyway, there'll be a certain amount of people will still stay. They can afford to stay in London. They like London, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of people already have moved out of London and will, I believe, continue to move out of London. Now, you will see an increase in property prices. You're already seeing it outside of London. The reality and the dominoes haven't fallen yet, where the property market reflects that reality in London, but it has to. There's no way it can avoid it. Now, there's obviously certain people who are in London and parts of London who are above the economy, which will keep the house prices reasonably high there. But this is going to have an effect on, your average kind of like two bedroom flat for 16, £1,800, £2,000. Those flats, I believe, in 18 months are going to be going for £1,200, £1,000 in parts of London, which a year would be unthinkable. I think that's coming down the tracks. In fact, I find the idea of maybe moving into London quite attractive because it's going to be quieter. It's going to be more peaceful. It's going to be less people there. The air is going to be clearer because there's going to be less cars. And the property's going to be cheaper. I could see an argument. And maybe other people will think like that, and there'll be a counter, move back into London by some. But I think largely this has, had an unprecedented and irreparable impact on London life, London trading, London, property market, everything really. Because those companies and, the cafes, the restaurants, the bars who are used to people piling out of work, particularly this time of year, and going into their establishments, those people aren't going to be there anymore. They're taking a double hit because of the lockdown and the just uncomfortable, imposing, awkward restrictions that are now present in restaurants. I went out for a meal last week for the first time, and it was just like they're all dressed in, like, you know, it's like being in a laboratory. They're all dressed in these face masks, and everyone's all nervous, and you know, it really ruins the experience. It's not the same. It's not relaxed. That's why you go out. So in the end, you think, why bother? You know, if this is not on some major level by design, I don't know which is worse, because this reveals that we are run by a serious bunch of incompetent clowns. This is, you know, if this is not by design on some level, then this has to be the biggest incompetent display of, I don't know, is there any hyperbole too hyperbolic here? I mean, this is a mess. So anyway, you're going to have that knock-on effect. And as much as I said people have got conditioned to some of the aspects that I think are dangerous for a society to get conditioned to, there's also aspects that people have got conditioned to, which is going to further discourage them from going back into work. I've already outlined, you know, from the company's point of view, this, you know, the damage done to their businesses and the further incentive then to save on commercial property. But what about the people working from home now, who have learned that it's a nice thing, it's a good thing. I've got more time, I've got more space. I can do in 5 hours without someone looking over my shoulder what would take me, you know, 8 hours, maybe 8.5 hours, depending on the commute and the rush in a normal day. You know, I guess in your 20s, when I was in my 20s, there was a kind of a buzz about that going down into London. But when you get into your 30s and beyond, I mean, that is just a drag. And, you know, it's not a friendly place to drive a car. Parking is difficult. There's, you know, it's expensive. If you make a mistake, you know, you're getting fines and, you know, the congestion charge. Of course, that's now increased as well, and it's every day. But what would you prefer? To get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and have an hour 15, maybe an hour 30 in some cases of a commute, and before you get into your office at 9 o'clock, and by the time you have your coffees and check probably your personal emails and wake up and start work at 9:30 or 10, and then, you know, you leave at 5 and you're not home till 6:30 again, and you have to do that commute at the end of the day every day, and the expense of that, of course. What would you prefer? I think most people would prefer to avoid that. Have an extra hour in bed or an extra 90 minutes in bed. Get up, relaxed, and do your work and just get it done without all the nonsense, without having to waste an hour going out for lunch and the expense of that and having your little chats in the office and stuff like that. I mean, you can still chat to people, you know, from home anyway, on the phone or whatever. But the point is, in many cases, notwithstanding people, I think, some people will miss that kind of interaction. But I think for the majority of people, they're going to enjoy working from home, the freedom that provides, the costings and the savings that it brings. And then the government wants to encourage people to go back to the offices. Now, all people have to do, and there probably is a significant percentage of people who are genuinely scared, but I think the majority of people are going to just like milk this and say, well, listen, COVID-19 is a get out of jail card for everybody now, you know? All you have to do is say you're scared. There's also, you know, you're scared of the virus. And there's all sorts of things that you get excused. And who can blame them when the government has created all this? And they're still persisting with this, with, you know, this fear-mongering by making us wear masks and imposing fines for those who don't. I mean, we saw this with the teachers, where the teachers, the Marxist unions kick in. There hasn't been one death by a teacher globally because of coronavirus, of those who've returned to school. This is a virus which affects people with compromised immune systems and the elderly, largely, notwithstanding some exceptions. But there's no danger for teachers to be going back into school. If there is any, it's tiny. There's more chance you would die, you know, from a traffic accident on the way to work. Is that an excuse not to go to work? I mean, we all take risks. Every day we take risks. So now you're going to be seeing this, this conundrum with, on one hand, the government's continuing with the fear mongering, on the other hand, it's encouraging people to go back to work, and we need to get the economy going, and blah, blah, blah. People don't want to go back to work, and all they've got to say is that they're scared, because that's what's happening. Because you could see this a couple of months ago when I started working. It's, I remember thinking, the coronavirus must be a lot worse in the in the office and in the work environment, because it's not. Once the lockdown started to be loosened, people were mingling all the time in high streets and shops, and a lot of people didn't seem too scared to me. So, as I say, maybe the coronavirus is more dangerous in the workplace. The reality is, I think most people are just taking the piss and they're milking it, and the government have caused it. Time flies. Half an hour is gone. I want to get, there's a couple of extra stories I wanted to get to, but the other thing is, it's just some of these rules. Why bring them in now with these face masks? And you don't have to wear them in pubs and cafes, but you have to wear them in restaurants, or you have to wear them when you go to Tesco. I mean, most people, they're it's a very short period of time that you're in there for most part, and you're not really spending much time being close to other people. You're just passing them by. And but you, you know and then the staff don't have to wear them, and because they're behind their little masks. But although there are people stacking shelves, presumably do they have to wear them or they don't? But you can spend the night in a pub, drinking all night, with people there in the vicinity, and the more they drink, probably the closer they get and the less they care. That's okay. You don't have to wear a mask, because obviously, how can you drink without wearing a mask? But then, so is the coronavirus not dangerous in the pub? So let's have some consistency here. And you don't have to wear them in cafes and restaurants, obviously, but I think you have to wear them in takeaways. I mean, it's so confusing. I mean, it's just like to say there's ambiguity. I mean, what's next? When you're in the cafe, do you have to wear a mask? I don't know. I mean, what's coming next? You can have ketchup on your burger, but not mayonnaise. But you can have mayonnaise on your kebab, as long as it's a large kebab with a portion of large cheesy chips. Otherwise, you can get a 25,000 fine, as long as you pay it within 15 minutes. What if it's a kebab shop and the new one, if the owner is 62 and a half and has willingly put mayo on your burger, the cost of the fine can be shared between Muhammad and the customer. This will be reduced by 10% if you've had your burger with the large chips and a can of zero sugar only Coca-Cola. We will accept, checks, but only if you wear gloves and two face masks to avoid infecting Her Majesty's, HMR Revenue Collection Services. And only if you've opened these accounts, I don't know, before 9:42 a.m. on the 28th of, February 2001, which is a leap year. So make sure you get it right. Or a surcharge of 2.835% will be added, reduced to 2.412% if you do it within 3 weeks, but only on Tuesdays and Wednesdays in September and October. I mean, the whole thing is just crazy. There's so many little, qualifiers, and it doesn't apply to this, but it applies to that. And I mean, it's incredible. It's laughable. I mean, they're making it up as they go along. I mean, I did that little, skit, but that's kind of almost so how it is. It's just like, you're allowed to do this, but you can't do that. And, if you, it's ridiculous. I got an article that I was looking at earlier today by Peter Hitchens. And I must say, Peter Hitchens has been outstanding in his discernment and his deciphering of what's been going on from the start. He has been in this country, I would say, almost alone, in terms of anyone with any profile. And he wasn't going to get on BBC News or Sky News or any of the main propaganda networks who drive a lot of this stuff. And he said from the start that There was no evidence to suggest that we needed to have a lockdown or that it would be effective. In fact, I think he worked out that the virus had peaked. It was the 7th of April, at a point where it was not even possible that the lockdown could have had any impact on it. We saw in Sweden, for example, they didn't have any lockdown there. They just allowed people to have common sense, and in some cases, that they didn't experience a dramatic rise in deaths, on average per their population. In fact, in some cases, it was a bit smaller. It was smaller than ours, I think. It was smaller than the United States. And his consistency and his discernment and his information gathering on this has been second to none, in my opinion. And he did an article a couple of days ago, or was it Sunday? Because he writes for the Daily Mail, and he said, "Face masks turn us into voiceless submissives. And it's not science forcing us to wear them, it's politics. In the name of COVID-19, the state has already thrust itself into every corner of our existence. It has become between husband and wives at the end of their lives. It has forbidden the old to embrace their grandchildren. It has denied us funerals and weddings. Locked the churches." That's another story. The churches, sadly, have been as compliant as everybody else. "Silenced the ancient monastic music of cathedral choirs and prevented the free worship of God for the first time in 800 years." Well, the church have allowed it. They could have just said no, and they could have taken what Christians have always taken down through, down through their history, which is persecution. And they still do. I mean, many Christians around the world and historically, there's an old saying, the blood of the church has been built in the martyr, or the church has been built in the blood of the martyrs, because people look on and see that these people really believe. What they believe. In fact, sometimes Muslim or other people, or people who are hostile to Christianity, I mean, will say, "Yeah, well, when you get into this sort of type of debate, with you believe what you believe and you died for what you believe." Some will say that, well, Muslims die for what they believe as well. But the early Christians didn't die for what they believed. They died for their testimony of what they saw. There's a big difference. But anyway, side issue. Christians don't really get persecuted today because they go a lot right along with the wider culture. If you want to know what Christians are going to be doing, all you got to, and if you want to know what Christians are going to be doing in about 10 years' time, and sadly, that's probably getting worse. It might even have caught up just to the present time. But it wasn't that long ago where you used to think, well, if you want to know what the church is going to be doing in about 7 years' time, just look at what the general culture is today. And they just sort of lag behind it a little bit, but eventually they just give in to everything. Now I think it's even worse. I think now just the church, for the most part, has no stance against anything, for the most part. So it's prevented the free worship of God, because you're not allowed to sing in churches for the first time in 800 years, and banned us, unless we are left wing, from holding or attending public meetings. He's obviously ostensibly referring to the complete ignoring of the safety measures put in place by the Marxist Black Lives Matter movement, another Marxist movement caring, pretending they care about something else. "It has ordered us to stay at home, scolded or fined us for sunbathing, going on country rambles, or even entering our front gardens. It has forced millions of us to stop working, sabotaged the educations at school and university of untold numbers of young people, and has become our boss and paymaster in the biggest state takeover of life and work ever attempted by non-communists." Well, surprises me a bit there, that he thinks they're non-communists. Most of our institutions, education systems, the monetary systems, the media have been infiltrated by basic, by far left Marxists who were at university in the 60s and 70s and are now in high positions in government, finance, media, you name it. That's where all this political correctness comes from. That's all cult. That's all political correctness is cultural Marxism. And all Marxism is a wrecking ball for what's already established, and that's why they want to tear down the statues, the revolutionaries, so they can start with their, they can start at year zero, with getting their utopia going. They dismantle all the institutions that are already established, and they've done a pretty good job of it anyway, because this country and the West generally is unrecognizable in every way from what it was 10, certainly 20, 30, 40 years ago. The amount of change that I've seen in my lifetime, culturally and even demographically. I mean, people who describe themselves as white British in the capital of London, the capital of England now, are a minority. I have to laugh. I think it's become more and more of a propaganda statement. You know, the BAME community, the Black, Asian, and ethnic minority ethnics, you know, it's starting to feel more, you're starting to feel more like, I mean, there's certain parts of London and other cities in this country that I've lived in where you feel that you are the minority. And that the real hatred and the racism is really directed against white people, certainly by the state and by the media and the institutions, because anybody who has any stance which is against the politically correct and this new woke, this woke movement over the last sort of 18 months, which is just politically correctness on steroids. And if you don't agree with that, you're a Nazi, you're a white supremacist, you're a danger to society, and the game is rigged against you. If you happen to be white and a male, you're in real trouble. If you're a, white male and a Christian, you may as well be Satan himself to these people. So the whole idea of the white supremacy is a myth. There is no white supremacy. There's white, there's white persecution. There's white survival. There's white misery. Because people feel uncomfortable. I certainly feel uncomfortable at times in my own country. Sometimes you almost feel homesick if you, if you're in certain parts of London. It's very disconcerting. But anyway, so there are certainly revolutionaries. And now it presumes to tell us, so he says, it goes on to say, soon we will discover that it has also wrecked an already wobbly economy, an economy which was just a staggering drunk based on debt. Low interest rates to encourage people to borrow money, and increasing deficits, which now, considering you're going to have some of the highest unemployment levels that this country's ever seen, where the, where's the government collecting the money from? If you've got that levels of unemployment, not only are they printing up unprecedented levels of number or of currency out of thin air, but there's much less of a workforce to collect the taxes from, to collect that money back from. So what you're going to see is just eye-watering taxes on the rich, which is very socialist in its thinking. And eventually, a reduction in public services. Probably the national. I think they're already going to nationalize the railways and stuff like that. So I'm glad I never have to travel on them, unless they eventually just ban cars. That wouldn't surprise me. But this is the dominoes haven't fallen yet. But you're going to see some serious misery. And I remember doing it in a video in March, and I said, you know, by the time even a quarter of the economic fallout of this has been experienced, and the reality of this has been experienced, people are going to be wishing they died from coronavirus. Poverty is misery. Not working is misery. Not eating the right foods is bad for your health. You're going to see people, you've already seen people, you know, just despairing a little bit more than normal, and the confusion. People are going to start taking more alcohol. I remember looking at figures. I did a story, drinking massively spiked during the lockdown. So did cannabis use, because that was, you're able to monitor that in the parts of America and the world where it's legal. So the implications of this are going to be, they're going to be far reaching, and they are going to be long term. So this is not a normal situation, and it's not going to be some V-shaped recovery. We haven't even got started with this yet. And I, you know, I remember a couple of months ago, but I still think a lot of people, most people don't realize that. Most people don't take the time to inform themselves. They don't look at things. And I, you know, I understand people are busy and stressed out and, you know, whatever, but a lot of people don't understand for whatever reason what's coming down the tracks for this, but it's not going to be pretty. And it just, it hasn't been experienced yet. But the, when they stop those furloughs, you're going to see this, you're going to start to see it then. That's going to be the start of this. They call it the new normal, the new misery, because a lot of those jobs are not going to be there, or you're going to be in some even worse job, government expansion jobs, where they're little office jobs, where you're going to be paid pittance. So soon we will discover that it has also wrecked an already wobbly economy and separated untold numbers of us from jobs and businesses we thought were safe. Soon too, it will also separate us from our savings. And of course, the money printing, it sadly, it penalizes people who have savings, because inflation, it wipes out, depending on how much the inflation could go to, but it could even go to hyperinflation. It wipes out a significant percentage of the buying power of your money, in quotes, which is currency, which is why people get into precious metals to hedge against inflation. People start to see, okay, this is getting out of hand. We see where this is going, and people want to hedge against inflation and protect themselves. If you've got, you know, if you've saved £300,000 for your retirement, and they've inflated the currency so badly that it only has the buying power of £200,000, that's a serious threat to your retirement. And all these bailouts, for example, companies can fiscally be irresponsible and think, well, we'll get bailed out. Why have savings? Because if I have savings, I'm not going to get the bailout, so why would I be a mug? I may as well just, you know, leverage up in the debt. Look at these mugs. Look at these fools saving money, which is not going to be worth anything. So, I mean, the whole financial system was, as I said, it was in bad shape anyway, and the coronavirus was just a pin that pricked a debt bubble, and it's a global debt bubble. And it's almost like a debt bubble in everything. You know, it's not like just the 2008 financial crisis in the housing market. This is a bond bubble. It's a currency bubble. It's a, you know, it's just a general national debt bubble. It's certainly a property bubble as well. You know, any sort of bubbles that you could have, they are there, and they're not going to be able to keep this going by quantitative easing, as they call it, which is simply money printing. That's all it is. They put these terms on it to make it sound as if it's some sort of sophisticated mechanism of economics. It's just money printing. So soon we will discover that it's also wrecked an already wobbly economy and separated untold numbers of us from our jobs and businesses we thought were safe. And it will also separate us from our savings through punishing tax and savage inflation. Of course, the tax as well, yeah. To pay for the disaster that has caused. Now, if they're going to tax the rich, what are the rich going to do? They'll leave. So then you're going to have even less job creation, because it's the rich people, not just the corrupt. When people think about the 1%, they think about this corrupt crowd in Wall Street and down in the City of London. But the 1% is bigger than that. There are genuine wealth creators, and those guys are just going to leave. They're just going to go off to Puerto Rico or Monaco or wherever they can avoid, you know, getting, you know, 60% of their money, you know, wiped out so they can pay people's rents and keep half the rest of the country going, because no one has any jobs, and then there's going to be less jobs. I can't see myself staying in the UK beyond 2 years, quite frankly. So through the punishing tax and savage inflation to pay for the disaster it has caused, now it presumes to tell us what to wear. And what it wants us to wear is a soggy cloth muzzle, a face nappy that turns its wearer from a normal human being into a mumbling, mouthless submissive. Yeah, that's not even hygienic, if you ask me. And you have to remember it all the time. And this, it seems, is popular. Is there nothing the modern British people will not put up with? And this is very tragic, too. It's like you've got the fight has gone out of people through this incremental. This is why I'm saying it's so important. You got to keep push back at some point, because it's just, they're just going to incrementally push further and further, and it gets harder once you've got used to something. You know, to then push back on it, because you do get used to something. But I think the younger generation generally, and the soil has been prepared that way in the culture and the media and the universities to be obedient, to be submissive, and to trust the governments. So it seems that there is nothing the modern British people will not put up with. Britain's mussel consumption is now so high that 6 months from now there will be reports of dolphins and whales floundering about in an ocean made sticky by millions of gallons of hand sanitizer as they choke in congealed clumps of used mussels. These items are set to become the new plastic bags. Why is this frenzy taking place? And here's the crux of the story. Richard, if we've got 5 minutes after 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, let me run over, because this is so important. Here is a clue. On July 12th, Deborah Cohen, the medical correspondent of BBC Two's Newsnight, revealed an astonishing thing. The World Health Organization had reversed its advice on face masks from don't wear them to do wear them. But the key fact was that it had not done so because of scientific information. The evidence had not backed the wearing of face coverings, but rather because of political lobbying. She revealed on Twitter that, quote, "We had been told by various resources that the World Health Organization committee reviewing the evidence had not backed masks, but they had recommended them due to political lobbying." She said the BBC had then put this to the World Health Organization, which did not deny it. The WHO said, "There is currently no evidence that wearing a mask, whether medical or other types, by healthy persons in the wider community setting, including universal community masking, can protect them from infection with respiratory viruses, including COVID-19, unquote, as we are about to be, you know, as I say, you can get a £100 fine for not wearing one when you go to get your groceries, of all things, you know. The American TV news channel CNN reported on March 31st that Mike Ryan, executive director of the World Health Organization Emergencies Program, had said at a briefing in Geneva, "There is no, quote, there is no specific evidence to suggest that the wearing of masks by the mass population has any potential benefit. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest the opposite in the misuse of wearing a mask properly or fitting it properly." A few weeks ago, the WHO changed its advice to say it advises that governments should encourage the general public to wear masks where there is widespread transmission and physical distancing is difficult, such as in public transport, in shops, or in other confined or crowded environments. Earlier the same month, England's chief medical officer, Chris Whitty, had said that wearing a face mask would do little to combat the outbreak, while noting that if someone was infected, they might reduce the danger of spreading the disease by covering their faces. Professor Whitty said wearing a face mask had almost no effect, not a little bit effect, almost no effect on reducing the risk of contracting the illness. He stated, "In terms of wearing a mask, our advice is clear, that wearing a mask if you don't have an infection reduces the risk, almost not at all. So we do not advise that." Also in March, the Advertising Standard Authority banned two firms' advertisements for masks, saying that the adverts were misleading, irresponsible, and likely to cause fear without justifiable reason. This is the problem with big government as well, of course, because the bigger the government, the bigger the dartboard is for the lobbying dart to land on. Someone is making a lot of money off these masks, and considering the moral dereliction of most of our politicians, one can easily imagine, if not expect, that someone is getting reasonably rich in government from making these masks mandatory. I saw a packet up there today in Tesco. I think it was a packet of five for £5. You know, so you have to pay for your own, you know, subjugation as well. Someone's getting rich. Someone's always getting rich. And the bigger the government is, the more lobbying can take place. If you haven't got a big government, there's nothing corporations can do for their monopolies because they lobby governments to create the monopolies and to I'm pretty sure Sadiq Khan is probably one of the richest men in London at the moment. That little weasel. Because everything about the guy spanks of a guy who's taken backhanders left, right, and center. At about the same time, Dr. Jenny Harries, and I can go into what I mean about Sadiq Khan another time, but there's plenty of concerning stories about him as well. Obviously, it's hard to prove, but I hope something comes out about him because that guy, I think, has all sorts of lobby groups which are anti-car, put it that way, in London. At about the same time, Dr. Jenny Harries, a deputy chief medical officer who I'd never heard of up until about three months ago, and I certainly didn't vote for her dictating to me what I can and can't do, warned that people could be putting themselves more at risk from contracting COVID by wearing muzzles. She said masks could actually trap the virus and cause the person wearing it to breathe it in. She explained for the average member of the public, walking down the street is not a good idea. On April the 3rd, the other deputy chief medical officer, Professor Jonathan Van Tam, said he did not believe healthy people wearing them would reduce the spread of the disease in the UK. The British government has also zigzagged. As recently as June 24th, in a series of official pamphlets for reopening shops and services, the Department for Business and Enterprise said repeatedly, the evidence of the benefit of using a face covering to protect others is weak and effect is likely to be small. This was true at the time and it is still true. The evidence is indeed weak. There is plenty of research showing that the case for muzzles is poor, especially a survey done for the dental profession 4 years ago, which quietly vanished from the internet after mask opponents began to cite it. The scientific papers in favor of muzzling are full of weak, hesitant words such as probably, could, and may, which can equally well be expressed as probably not, could not, or may not. So I think you get the picture. And the whole idea of this was to, you know, apparently encourage business to grow. It's going to stress people out what it's going to do. I was talking to the girl in Tesco and she said she was nervous about it because, you know, customers might, might kick off if someone challenges them, and she didn't want to wear them and, or just even having police around and stuff. And she said she wasn't looking forward to them coming in. And she said a very good thing as well. She said, why are they doing it now when the worst of it's, you know, well over? And of course you have people in shops. I mean, people are struggling. I mean, it's okay for Tesco and Sainsbury's and everything else. But if you're a guy who's, you know, really struggling right now, and I don't know, say you have a DIY store, say you have a furniture store, say you sell beds, whatever. You know, you've got potential customers coming in. What are you going to do, phone the police on them? Say you can't come in here because you haven't got a mask on for a virus which kills largely, and it is an overwhelmingly large percentage of people who are old and already suffer from compromised immune systems through things like obesity, respiratory problems, diabetes, even heart disease and cancer are listed on that list. I mean, those are things that are going to kill you anyway. And again, remember, a lot of people die with coronavirus, not of coronavirus. If you're a guy, you're trying to make money, we take risks every day. You probably have more risk of dying driving to your business every day than having someone coming in and giving it to you. And then, of course, you get the whole quarantine thing. This is something that came up in my church today that has actually put me off additionally going to church, apart from the fact that they don't want to sing or they're not going to sing, which I struggle with. And I'm trying to keep a relationship going with my church, but, you know, I don't agree with it. And out of principle, I don't really want to be involved with it in the actual sort of Sunday service. But as one of the guys pointed out to me today, someone was coughing at church last week, and immediately they had to go and get tested for COVID-19. And if he had tested positive, everybody in that church would have had to quarantine for 2 weeks. Well, what that's fine for people who are working in government and the government's on their side. And, oh, okay, well, you're isolating, you still get your wages, or people who can still, or the pastor, you know, he's on a salary, and you know, people who are economically in good shape. But what if you can't afford to take 2 weeks off and lose the money? What if you lose your job over because you haven't you can't go to work for 2 weeks? It's really put me off. It's a practical thing. I mean, I feel the need to go anyway, and I think that's the final straw, to be honest. You know, there's nowhere in my Bible tells me that I have to go to a church building on a Sunday. It's called religion. That's not how the early church worked. It was a spiritual movement. They didn't do that. They used to meet up in the mornings. They used to meet in people's houses. They used to meet in the synagogues before they were persecuted. As I say, you're not going to see a lot of the church being persecuted today. It'll be an absolute last resort for them, because they would do everything and anything possible to avoid it if they possibly could. And it has to get that bad before they'll finally push back. And as I say, once you've got used to things getting worse, that's like a little, like those little TV, you know, those little video games where you see your little battery life going down. If you can't push back when your battery's strong, it's going to be much more difficult for you when you've already got used to worse things and the state has got more bold and more powerful. You're in a weaker position. You'd been better pushing back when you were in a stronger position before they had acquired more ground. I've said all this. I think my tactics on this with the church and the whole psychology of it is correct, and no one really wants to listen, so it is what it is, and lots of people have to suffer. Love your neighbor. Well, poverty kills, and so do Bolsheviks, particularly if you're a Christian. So it is a complex situation in one way for the church, and another way, to me, it's very straightforward. I don't necessarily think it has to be complicated. It only gets complicated if you don't have a clear position on it and you don't have a clear stance on it and you're not prepared to suffer a little bit. But Christians, you know, they shouldn't really worry about all these types of things. They should let the Lord take care of them. You know, if someone files a lawsuit, you know, or whatever, you know, if something like that happens, just do the right thing and let the Lord pay for it. And if there's Christians listening thinking, yeah, well, that's not very realistic, that means that something's more real to you than God. That means you're not a believer. That's what a believer is. If you're a non-Christian and you're listening, you might think, well, you know, you're a fool for believing. But if you're a Christian, you do believe, and you've got good reason to believe. If, well, I think a lot of Christians don't have good reason to believe, and that's the problem. They've never done any research. They've never really had any real experience of God, and they don't know why they believe. So whenever things get up, you know, things get difficult, you see what they really believe, and you see what they really obey, and what's real to them. And what happens is, for those who don't want to compromise, they end up being isolated. And I had a conversation with one of my elders today, and I said to him, you know, he said to me, it was kind of like pushing back at me a little bit and saying, you know, if you're waiting for the perfect church, you know, you're just going to be sort of isolating, you know, as if I'm, you know, as if the problem's more at my end, like I'm a rebel. And I said to him, no, because the church keeps compromising, and then you either have a choice of compromising with them, or you end up where the church is causing you to isolate, because because the church has made its position clear, which is a compromising position for whatever reasons. In my little local church, I think probably well-meaning reasons, but still, I think they made wrong decisions already. And if you don't want to be part of it, you know, it's because you've got a principle on it and you don't want to compromise. So it's the church has caused you because to compromise, to be isolated. And this is a ubiquitous phenomenon among Christians in the last 20,000 years, or in the last 20,000 years, in the last 20 or 30 years, where Christians, they don't go to their little local churches anymore because compromise, and they're so diluted, and Christianity is just so unrecognizable from the actual scriptures. And so a lot of people end up isolated and are struggling for, you know, regular fellowship, and you know, people are listening, you know, they get disillusioned, and they go to one church and there's problems, and they go to another church and there's a lot even bigger problems, and you know, so they end up, you know, having less fellowship, and watching things online. I mean, I don't need to go to a church on a Sunday to listen to a sermon or do a Bible study. We've got the internet. It's one of the most amazing resources available. If you want to learn about anything today, you can learn as much as you want. Reality is, you'll learn better information online than you would at your local church. Reality, because local churches quite often are sort of, you know, very ignorant, and you know they have a very narrow view of things. And I don't say ignorant in an insulting way. Things lacking in knowledge for whatever reason. People have busy lives, or they're, you know, or it's apathy, or whatever. You know, when you have a radio show like this, and you're interviewing certain people, and you're learning, and you've been learning over the years, and studying heavily, and you go into a local church, it's like a different world. It's like the gulf is so big, it's so uncomfortable. I don't know where to start. It's very difficult. But anyway, the church sadly is no different than what's happening in the wider culture. But you know, there are people out there who feel the same way as I do, and I think you're going to see them now. What you're going to see is quite an interesting phenomenon now. People are going to the shops. You're going to start to see people making friends with each other, and who know each other, who are not wearing masks. You've seen it already. I was up at Tesco earlier, and I think, you know, you're already seeing people. I would say it's probably even like 50-50, might be a bit generous. Maybe I would say maybe 60-65% wearing them, 35% not. And you can see the people who are not wearing them, sort of like eye contact being made and things like that. And because they know that they're actually sort of in a position where they could be fined. They're doing something, you know, in quotes, illegal. But, you know, you're going to see people, solidarity between people who believe that this thing's overhyped, believe that the cure is worse than the disease, pertaining to, you know, the destruction of the economy and the fallout of that as a result of COVID-19, because certainly the cure that the government provided is worse than the disease, and that hasn't been fully experienced yet. So it's going to be an interesting time over the next few weeks. I shudder to think, are they going to ask, you know, the church to wear masks in the church as well? I think that has to be the line in the sand for the church. I really do. Because maybe they've been, you know, trying to do the right thing and for a while, but there has to come a time when they take a stand and say, no, you know, we have to recognize the highest authority of Christ ultimately, and you are, and already, in my opinion, the church, the state is outside of its legitimate realm of authority in the church according to the scriptures. Anyway, I will leave it there tonight. I am very tired. I've had a very long day. I didn't sleep very much last night. I was up watching different videos and feeling a bit excited about silver and mauling over conversations I've had with my pastors. They were quite, and the leadership of the church, they were quite heavy conversations and uncomfortable conversations at times, but conversations that had to be had, and it is what it is. And sometimes you just have to take a stand and see where the chips fall. Thank you for tuning in, folks, and I'll be back again next Thursday. What date is next Thursday? The 30th. Yeah, I mean, I sometimes think by the time we get out of all this and by the time they start lifting the restrictions, it's almost immediately we're going to be hit with, you know, another lockdown. I can see that happening. I can see a lockdown coming in September. I really can. I can just see the chaos of 2020 just continuing. I really can. It's just going to be, I honestly can see it happening. You know, probably another exaggerated situation. Boris Johnson has said that he won't impose another lockdown. But I think, who was it said, if a politician denies something three times, you can take that as fact that it's going to happen. So he's got twice more to deny he's not going to do a lockdown, and we can probably start preparing for it. All right, folks, I will be back next Thursday. That's the 30th, same time. In fact, it won't be the same time. It'll be from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m., so which is 4 till 5 Eastern time. Again, I forgot to give out the number. I always do for call-ins. Do call in again next week. I'll give out the number. And also, if you want to donate to the work I do and the network, because we're 100% listeners supported, you can do that if you go on to revisionmedia.org. Anything is appreciated. If you want to donate to the work I do here, you can do that on PayPal. It's just Stevenson_P5@sky.com. And it would be appreciated, because I'm a bit skint at the minute, actually. So anyway, until then, what was this? Was there something else? There was something else that I was supposed to do. I need to take a note more of what I'm supposed to do, guys, when I'm doing the show. Oh yeah, shout out to George. George, I'll see you tomorrow, mate. If you did manage to tune in, I hope you enjoyed the show. Quite a heavy show tonight. It's not always that heavy. It's usually a bit lighter in spirit and a bit more entertaining, I suppose. But I'm very tired, mate, as you well know. Anyway, until then, take care and God bless. Stay safe.